Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone and Happy New Year. We have officially arrived in 2011. I hope you all are very excited about it. I know some people kind of dread the new year. They hate New Year's resolutions. For me, I actually kind of get off on it. I like to make all kinds of charts and graphs about what I'm doing and where I'm going. And I suppose some of my excitement is usually that I am able to achieve quite a few of my goals. So anyhow, we are, for some reason, stuck on this topic of pedophilia and incest. So hang on, because we're going into part two. Last week, we talked about sexual abuse with the clergy. And tonight, we're going to be talking with my friend Cal, who was raised in the Orthodox Jewish community. And he is a survivor of sexual abuse, and I'm actually going to be, asking him some questions about his personal story. But he's here also to talk about a program that he has founded called Voices of Dignity, and it's a nonprofit dedicated to ending the cycle of child sexual abuse. Cal, thanks for being on the Shame-Free Zone.
Thank you so much.
Now, you're located in, are you in New York tonight?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, yeah. So Cal and I actually met in San Francisco years ago. Should we tell them where we met?
Sure.
Yeah. Go ahead. You tell the story.
We met actually right when you were doing a workshop in San Francisco at One Taste.
Absolutely. And One Taste is actually a pretty sexually progressive place.
Right.
So, and I actually think that's kind of a nice jumping off point because for a lot of people, I think when they think about somebody who's dealing with sexual abuse issues like rape or incest, some sex negativity comes up, you know, about how we can't also enjoy sex because we're so busy looking at how it can be used inappropriately.
Right.
Yeah. What's your experience been around that?
Actually, I've had a lot of experience on both directions, like from people that have had severe sexual abuse growing up and then have made the effort to work through some of the shame and a lot of the stigma around it and now can enjoy healthy sexuality. And I've found just the opposite as well, where just talking about sexuality, given that I've had experience of sexual abuse as a child, that there's so much more stigma around it. So inevitably, like in engaging sexually or having a conversation about sex positivity, usually people think it's a result because of my abuse.
Right. Like you are somehow or another stuck on being on the effects of the abuse, and so you're over-sexualized or whatever.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me really to know why I have such a passion to find freedom around sexuality. Is it because of my abuse? It's kind of like it's a question that has not been as important rather than finding freedom around it, which has definitely been a topic for most of my life. Given that I, at a very young age, I got to learn what it is to be surrounded by people in power that misuse power and sexuality at the same time.
I've had a similar path. I think the reason I became a sexologist, the reason I got into the sex industry before that, definitely had a lot to do with the sexual abuse. But you know, where I part company with most conventional thinking on the topic is that I don't think that that's a problem. I think we all find the arenas where we will heal ourselves. And, you know, it makes me think sometimes about differently abled persons. You know, I've read about some guy who lost a leg and he won the Olympics, you know, running.
Right.
I think, you know, you may have obstacles in your life that actually propel you forward to master a particular area. I know for myself, pursuing sex in a positive, empowering vein certainly helped take my recovery around incest and rape to a new level. I, in fact, sometimes jokingly refer to, you know, the years and years that I spent in 12-step model and in therapy was like the homework, but actually getting out and having sex for, you know, whether it was professionally or personally, was the lab work.
Yeah, that's what I find a lot of people having trouble with understanding. That, you know, like the concept that I was told so many years ago, like to find freedom in something, I won't be able to go around it and have it be theoretical. I'll have to go into it where there's the most fear, or go into the emotions and the feelings that was the most terrifying. And for some reason, people don't understand that that actually means practically being sexual and have the things that I'm the most afraid of show up and recontextualize them or re-confront them in a way where it's not re-traumatizing, but definitely in a way where there's freedom around it. And I think we've had that conversation many times where that's kind of where the context of role-playing and being able to put myself in an environment where the old emotions and feelings will come up, but be able to find freedom around it and know that I have choice around the current extent as an adult.
When I was growing up, I was raised in a religious home, just as you were.
Right.
And in my case, we read the Bible. We were very much about the Old Testament Bible. So the religion that I was raised in was a Christian cult that emulated a lot of Jewish, ancient Jewish traditions. So we didn't have Hanukkah, but we had something called the Feast of Tabernacles and Day of Atonement, Passover. We did not keep Easter or Christmas. We considered those pagan holidays. And and then we didn't eat pork or shellfish. So in a lot of ways, I always felt quite a bit of just kind of a kindred connection to the Jewish culture because of the way I was raised. But anyway, in reading the Old Testament Bible, I certainly, I found it a huge turnoff to religion. I was hoping to feel otherwise as a young, devout child of 12, but when I finished reading the Bible, I actually felt kind of sick to my stomach. But, you know, there is a verse from the New Testament, you know, that pertains to being able to tell what people are about by, you know, basically their fruits, you know. What do their actions produce?
Right.
And when I think about the prevailing model of so-called recovery around sexual abuse, whether it's incest or rape, it seems that the fruits of that are often to go through life pretty protected, withdrawn, angry. It's like there's no model for a full sexual recovery being offered. Now, you know, I know some exceptions to that. I think Stacey Haynes has a fabulous book called The Survivor's Guide to Sex, and I recommend it to my clients all the time. But for the most part, it's like, you know, if you have been abused, the only way that you can convince people that it was as horrific as it was is if you continue to approach sex as if it was something horrible even now. You know, like you never get to rejoice in it and celebrate it and find it to be fun.
Right.
Unless, of course,
it's something that can be enjoyable.
Right. Right. You certainly wouldn't, you know, be able to be promiscuous. You know, if you are going to enjoy it, you should get married and procreate.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm curious. I know your Voices of Dignity, is that focusing on the Jewish community, or are you reaching out to communities at large? Or can you tell us a little bit about that?
In the organization, Voice of Dignity is mainly focused on the Jewish community. And over the last year, we've been running a lot of programs here in New York and creating models of certain programs that I will talk a little bit more about in a little bit that will be able to be used in any community anywhere in the world. But we want to test, I guess it's like my way, my contribution to the community that I grew up in, where I saw nothing was really being done in a way where there's practical solutions being offered in the homes where parents or mothers don't really have any resources or ways of speaking with their kids about abuse to prevent it, and if it has occurred, how to deal with it, given that they're so insular.
Right.
So I came back to New York from the West Coast where we've met. I came back like a year and a half ago, started speaking to a lot of survivors and victims, and was just horrified by the hopelessness of victims where they didn't really know where to turn. So we tried lots of different things, and we started this mother's training where monthly we run them in a couple different communities, and they're growing really fast, where we bring in a professional, a trauma specialist, to speak with mothers about a whole curriculum that we've developed, an 8-segment curriculum, where you basically were confronting the whole cycle of sexual abuse. So what creates abuse, the different types of abuse, signs and symptoms of abuse, how to speak to your kids about abuse, the criminal justice system, how to report, different models, therapeutic models. So we've been really successful, and I'm blown away because I thought that I was going to confront a lot of resistance. And just like all other cultures that have seen such incredible change happen from within communities, especially insular communities, we've found mothers being incredibly receptive to it. And in every training, we keep being blown away where mothers are constantly sharing about their own abuse that they suffered as children and never shared about it before. And we're getting a lot of stories of children who are currently being abused. So it's about like the only program that I know that is being offered where we're confronting the problem where the problem lives. So rather than looking at statistics where we kind of like, we want to get statistics of people who have been abused years ago, we're more confronting, like speaking with parents about how to notice the changes in behavior in their children to be able to detect if something is going on. And a lot of the times in the grooming process of abuse, children coming home with prizes, children coming home with money, children acting out different. And usually if mothers don't know what to look for, and especially if they've suffered abuse, there's almost this blind spot where they don't want to look at it because they've never confronted it in their own lives. So we've connected these mothers with professionals in the criminal justice system, with detectives that we work with. So by the time they leave, not only are they leaving with information how to confront the problem, but they're also leaving with resources that they can reach out to if they want to.
Okay, and again, that is for the Jewish community?
That is for the Jewish community, but we're creating it in a way where mothers or people will be able to download them and be able to incorporate them into their communities anywhere.
Okay. And as far as, so let me see if I get this right. You're saying that, as far as you know, you're the only program that is teaching awareness in order to intercept it before the abuse happens.
Before, and also if the abuse is occurring, you and I know, and professionals have proven this so time and time again, even if somebody just recently suffered abuse, there's so much more possibility of healing abuse right after it happened rather than living with so much shame for years. Shame and blame and like secrecy of not sharing about abuse. So we're just constantly looking at the cycle of abuse as it continues. So many teenagers and so many minors who are abusing other kids have suffered abuse. So it's like looking at the full cycle, that if we can intercept it in families, in homes, where parents can learn to speak to their children and notice when abuse is happening and get them treatment right away and to stop their abusers, the likelihood of the cycle of abuse not continuing is much higher.
Now, if we talk about the pattern of parents, and in this case you're talking about mothers having been abused too, but do we find that to be a pretty prevalent pattern of that? I'm thinking like children who are survivors of incest grow up and marry each other.
That I don't know as much, other than I have observed a lot in my own experience and also a lot of the survivors that I've spoken with, the intergenerational cycle of abuse. So for an instance, if you isolate my own experience, my mother is a survivor of incest of her father.
Right.
He was a Holocaust survivor and was tortured and raped for years. And I was the only one after my father who would ever know about it when I started dealing with, like, recovering from my own abuse. So it's like that cycle of abuse continues, whereas in my generation, I didn't suffer abuse from my parents, at least not sexual abuse. It happened in my community by one of, like, the community leaders, and I didn't share about it until I was 18. What you're looking at, that intergenerational, where abuse continues and continues and the secrecy continues, whereas if it can be interrupted with the right resources, well, lots of children will be saved.
Okay. So can you list some of those for us? Like, what are some of the things that can you mentioned some things like toys and money.
I mean, in my instance, there was a whole grooming process where, like, I developed this friendly relationship with this community leader in my community, and I started receiving money. And then by the time the sexual abuse started, there was so much shame where I couldn't go. There wasn't anywhere that I can share about it. And not only not share about it, I didn't think anyone would believe me. Like, growing up in a culture, I don't know if it was like that in the community you grew up in, but we grew up believing that adults are always right. Leaders are always right, and they're always to be trusted. Not only that, that if I was going to speak against somebody, who would believe me? So there's a lot of abuse that I watched happen in my community where I didn't dare talk about it. But there was just years and years of keeping it inside. And then the whole story of my own personal life took place, where I ran away from home really young, ended up in the streets and got involved with drugs and alcohol and any form of escape possible, until none of those worked anymore.
Yes, and I do think that it's definitely, well, I suppose there seem to be like a couple of ways. Either you become very promiscuous and you act out and do a lot of drugs and alcohol, or maybe you become kind of withdrawn.
Right.
Some incest survivors put on a lot of weight to kind of try to protect themselves from any kind of
attention.
Right,
but there's definitely a mantra where has guided me in through building the organization and creating an amazing team that we're working with, that childhood sexual abuse is preventable. So many people get so overwhelmed by it because so many people have suffered abuse. It's almost like, oh, it's inevitable. It's going to happen. Where childhood sexual abuse can be prevented, like, given a healthy environment, it doesn't have to happen. I know it sounds very simple. It's almost like, well, you don't have to kill children. But sexual abuse is preventable. And that's kind of like the model that leads us to, that keeps me going and inspired to keep providing information and resources for parents in these incest communities to prevent abuse from happening in the first place.
So what are some of the things that parents should look for? And you're talking about educating the mothers, by the way. What about the fathers?
Good question. I have not put in a lot of emphasis on it at the moment.
Okay.
It's very possible that it will happen afterwards. Everything that we've studied from different cultures to the Jewish culture, there's something really magical that happens with the compassion and the dedication of mothers, where they seem to be more interested. Like an example of one of the mother that showed up at one of our first trainings, and she basically called us afterwards and told us that she can't come back. Her husband threatened her not to come. Whereas, like, my association and also what I see in those communities where men have more power, that for a husband, like, his issue was, well, was it endorsed by a rabbi? Or was it endorsed by the community leaders? Whereas a mother, it's more like they care about their children. They want to make sure that their children are protected. And our goal, like, we have three different goals with running these programs. One is that mothers can have information and resources. Two, that they can create a network amongst themselves to support each other as they're coming out to talk about abuse or as they want to confront other community leaders about abuse. But eventually, for us to be able to create the right curriculums in schools and enough change in the communities, I feel that that kind of change is going to come from mothers that care about their children. And I see that in my own life. My mother has been incredibly dedicated and supportive of the organization. She's actually helped start a few groups in the community I grew up in. So do men need education? Yes. It's not an area that we've personally focused on.
Is there some attitude that women or mothers don't molest their kids?
Statistically, we know that mothers do. They have. The statistics are definitely higher with men doing that.
Okay.
But it's definitely an arena that professionals are still being more and more educated about.
Right.
There are definitely female offenders. Like, I'm not saying that they're free of that.
In my case,
I don't have personal experience with that. I know my mom was very withdrawn for a lot of years. She got really involved in the community with a lot of community service, and she was trying to save the whole world, not spending a lot of time at home. And after I confronted my own abuse and spent a lot of time with my parents learning about their background, I understood a lot more why my mother chose to be so distracted helping the whole world. And that's also one of those manifestations of dealing with so much trauma.
So your mother was abused. Was she abused by a family member?
She was abused by her father.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and I mean, it's fascinating, like the amount of guilt, and it's almost like she never felt that she can ever confront him because he was a Holocaust survivor and he suffered so much and he was so respected
in the
community. Yeah.
That was going to be my next question. What are some of the issues that are peculiar or specific to the Jewish community? And that certainly sounds like one.
I mean, in the Jewish community, there's a lot of, given that they're so insular and the traditional life that they live, there's definitely a huge stigma of if, like, one of my cousins came out to share about her abuse, she was abused by one of my uncles. And it was also one of this incredibly horrific stories of years and years of abuse.
Right.
And she was terrified to ever share about it because how it's going to make the family look like. And it's going to interfere with people marrying into the family. So there's definitely this whole stigma around if you come out to talk about it, you're going to ruin the whole family.
Oh.
So it took incredible amount of courage. And by the time she came out to share about it, she'd left the community.
Wow.
And was totally shamed. And so I feel like that's something. I want to backtrack for a second then and come back to my experience. Like, a lot of times people ask me why I'm so passionate to speak out. And in my early years, when I started talking about childhood sexual abuse openly in public, people, like, I would see how it affected people. I've definitely noticed how people are terrified to talk about it, especially in public. And it brought me back when I was 18 and I was in rehab and was going through my own recovery around all the trauma that I went through growing up. And I remember at one of my lowest points where I was like suicidal and I just, one of like my darkest moments in life. And my friend Mike came up to me and he was like, Hal, well, maybe, I guess he noticed how I looked and he identified where I was at. And he was like, Hal, maybe it's not worth living. Imagine in a couple years from now, there's going to be another human being that will have the same exact experience than you. And you will be the only person to save that person's life by sharing your experience and being courageous how you dealt with your abuse. Like, wouldn't you want to live to see that? Mm. And that switched something in me where it gave me the courage that perhaps me dealing with my trauma and me dealing with my pain, I will be able to identify with another human being, and that will give that person courage and hope to live. And I got to watch that happen over the years and with some incredible, incredible stories where people that I was willing to share about my experience would go back to their communities and confront their abusers and deal with their abuse. And there's something really incredibly powerful about that.
And, there is. In my experience, that's definitely the 12-step model. You know,
right.
Your experience strengthen up, right?
Right.
And you've actually done quite a bit of therapy, including 12-step.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I went to, like, Incest Survivors Anonymous. I went to Ritual Abuse Survivors Anonymous. I've found those to be very helpful. It's kind of difficult sometimes to apply the 12-step model to being an incest survivor, but, because of the whole taking your own inventory thing.
Right.
And, but I think you have to be very careful, because it's not like you had a part in creating your own abuse. But certainly getting the focus back on the one thing that you have the power to change, which is yourself.
Right.
And, you know, looking for a positive way to move forward rather than just staying focused on your anger and rage, which I think is absolutely essential that you get angry too. But you just don't want to stay there.
Right, right. I definitely, like, if anybody is listening to the show, and as I know there's so many that are listening, and so often I get to hear, it's almost like these false belief systems that happen around survivors of sexual abuse, where it's almost like the one extreme will be, oh, now I'm damaged goods. But the other extreme would be like, well, once you've suffered so much abuse, you can't really 100% recover. And I found that to be an absolute lie. Like, the amount of freedom and excitement I have around my sexuality is enormous. And it is possible, but I definitely have seen, like, the somatic experience around trauma and abuse, holding so much into my body and being locked in these cycles of pain and the stories around the abuse, where freedom around that is possible, but it definitely does not happen by escaping it. It does not happen by trying to cover it up. That's like, I definitely remember having conversations with you. It's like confronting those demons was incredibly beneficial for me.
I have, it's invaluable. And I think about, you know, God, it's just like the end result. What kind of an end result do you want? Do you want to be somebody who is back in your body, first and foremost? Because, you know, if you have been sexually abused at a very early age, you're spending a lot of your time outside of your body.
Right.
And there's kind of this level of numbness, this low emotional affectation, so that you're not really fully joyful, not really fully sad. You know, it's always kind of foggy. There's like a filter between you and your feelings.
Right.
And to get back, I remember after about 4 years of intensive therapy around the incest issues, and you know, I also got clean and sober. About 4 years into that, I can remember the first time that I laughed at something that I saw in a movie or something, and I felt it all the way to my toes, and it was such an unfamiliar feeling. You know, I I had no recollection of having ever felt that way in my entire life. And for myself, I stopped being in my body and stopped being me when I was 4 years old. So, you know, that's a lot to lose. That's a huge chunk of the childhood to lose.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and so reclaiming that can be quite a journey, too, just trying to reclaim how to play, you know, how to reconnect with some of those things. I remember as an adult going and buying myself a Barbie doll because I never got to have one as a kid. What kind of things did your journey, did your personal journey entail? I'm just wondering, like, if, you know, share how you got from being easily triggered and shut down to being somebody who could take a playful, more carefree approach to sex. How did you make that journey?
Well, when you've met me in San Francisco, that was definitely a part of that journey, which kind of led me to this point. But going back years ago, like, I didn't take the route of being kind of retrieving or going into myself. I went into the route of extreme violence and constantly acting out. And so by the time I was completely beat up and was going to rehab and went into the 12-step program, dealing with all those emotions. And I remember I was sitting actually today for coffee with a survivor, and I was looking at her and her whole body was shaking, and I kept checking in with her, and she was terrified. She was telling me about her experience of abuse, and she wasn't used to sharing about it. And we started talking about meditation, which was a huge, huge part of my life since I was 18, and that definitely helped with my own personal abuse on a very somatic experience. And so we were talking about her taking on a practice of, like, sitting with herself. She's like, I never sit by myself. I'm terrified to sit by myself. I need loud noise. I need to listen to music or to distract myself. And I told her, I was reminded of an experience when I was living in Florida after rehab, where the first time I decided to spend a day by myself, which felt extremely foreign to me. It's something I've never done. I've always been around people or high or loud music or loud television. And I remember where I committed myself to sit in my room for a couple of hours, where I was sitting on my hands and it felt like I was sitting on needles. My whole body was shaking. I was sweating. Just the conscious effort of being with the noise in my head and the extreme pain in my body. And that has been, like, yoga meditation has been a huge part of reclaiming or coming back to myself, of just being comfortable living in myself. Because, like, what I found, and you kind of mentioned a little bit before, like, I was trained definitely with the traumas that I went through. Like, the intensity will come on, or I will get triggered by something, and then I would do these certain things to escape them. Which meant, like, my experience of life was fairly limited because I would get triggered and all of a sudden I would run to the escape. And at different times in my life, I looked in different ways until I got to a point when I was 18 where, like, I started making a conscious effort of doing the opposite, where I wouldn't, like, the idea started dawning on me that I can't be free having something unless if I'm okay not having it. And to just be with the uncomfortability of wanting to react to something and being until I don't have to and then being able to choose it. And it was something that I played with for years in a lot of different domains. And it's, with sex, it's very similar. Like, if it was compulsive where I had to have it, not to have it until I was okay being with myself. And then when I'm okay with not having it, then choosing it. So that was, like, an interesting practice that I kind of, over the years, started watching the compulsiveness around it and then choosing the opposite of that.
Yeah, I think I did the same thing around sex. You know, in the very beginning when I first got clean and sober and I was starting, therapy around incest issues, I looked very much at the sexual obsessiveness. And, and it became very important to me why I would have sex, you know, what my motivations were.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly as an incest survivor who's not recovered, at least for myself, I know a lot of other incest survivors, the motivation would often be wanting to feel loved, accepted, you know,
right.
getting approval.
Right. And I always liken that. It's similar to going into a shoe store wanting to buy ice cream and getting upset why they don't have it.
That's good.
And you can have that analogy in so many different ways, but it's like expecting to be filled up because I'm in this perfect relationship doesn't really work.
Right. Yeah.
It's very similar. Like if I can be with myself and be fulfilled, I can choose to be with somebody else and show up the relationship perfect or at least whole without needing to have a certain form of approval. And yeah, you're exactly right.
I think about all the meaningless sex that I had, that, you know, where I was just a lonely kid who wanted to be loved, wanted to feel loved, and how incredibly lonely I'd feel after having sex with strangers, you know, just horrible. And the contrast between that and being in recovery, having gone through years of therapy, and really making that journey of healing, so that by the time, and you know, this is the part that I have so much trouble getting, you know, people to understand or comprehend my personal story, to go from that lonely, sexually abused child to being somebody who is actually engaging in sex professionally and finding it to be a lot of fun and excitement and empowering and even yeah. part of my spiritual path. It's like, you know, it's a
I'm
heck
sure
of a journey.
Odd idea for a lot
huh?
of people.
What?
Which I'm sure was a very odd idea for a lot of people.
It still is. It still is. It's a mind-bending concept for most people. But, you know, usually when they meet me or they come to one of my workshops or lectures, they walk away often kind of scratching their heads because they can tell I'm full of joy. So,
right.
you know, you can't fake that. You can't
right.
fake that. If you're happy and, you know, it's just kind of pouring out of every fiber of your being, it's going to show.
I wonder how you do with it, because I definitely, like, one of the things that I still deal with, which is sometimes really confronting, is I'm so comfortable with it, and it's almost like people around me would tell me, like, almost like keep it down. Like, try mm-hmm. to tame it. I went to a friend's house a few weeks ago, and it was in a religious environment, and I went for a meal. I went for a weekend on the Sabbath. And I found out a few weeks later that me being there just having dinner with the family created a lot of family issues. And I was like, I don't understand. And they're basically explaining that her younger sister was there, and all of a sudden, like, the father noticed that she was more outspoken, and she was almost, like, flirtatious. And all of a sudden, like, I went in my head, it was like, okay, I'm going to try not to go into the place where I find myself wrong or at fault, that people around me were getting turned on because I just show up being open.
Yes.
And I know this doesn't only happen in religious environments. It's like I would walk into a place and all of a sudden other people's fears and insecurities around them feeling uncomfortable around their sex comes out.
That's
and
true.
I'm quite outspoken and quite comfortable around sexuality. And it creates a lot of tension many times with people around me.
Well, you know, Cal, I've also noticed that people are very uncomfortable with joy. It's
right.
like, don't be too sexual, don't be too happy, don't have too much pleasure, you know. Don't
right,
laugh
yeah.
too hard, don't cry. There's an awful lot of pressure in our modern culture, which seems to compel people to feel like they kind of have to act like they're little machines or something, or shut down. You think about some of the things, some of the images that our media promotes, like the disaffected model, you know, who snarls with curling her upper lip at you. It's like, you know, we they couldn't possibly have glamour shots where they're smiling.
Right.
It seems like in a lot of ways. I know in the home I grew up in, my father actually would sulk if I had a good time without him. If I came home from church and he said, "How was church?" And if I said, "Oh, we had a great time, we went to potluck," I could just see my father's face drop. And so I learned very early on to say, "It was okay."
Right.
I think a lot of kids do that in school too. You know, it's like you don't want to act like something's too important because they might try to take it away from you.
Right.
That's actually where lying starts. Did you know this? They've traced lying to the large apes, like chimpanzees, and it's all about food. So if they find food, then the ape will go out of its way to try to pretend that they're not excited about it. Because they don't want the other apes to know that there's food over there. So then the first lie is really about tamping down your joy.
Right, it can't be too good. Then somebody will ruin it.
Yeah, try to take it away from you.
Right, but that's where the conversation comes in, and I think the principle of your show kind of says it all, of like, can I create a space where shame doesn't exist, where I can hold other people's judgment and still not have to minimize my experience? And I think that's a conversation that has been an ongoing thing, especially with running an organization that deals with such a sensitive topic. It brings out all kinds of emotions in people. And it's kind of like to stay strong and keep being inspired and tell my story again and again and see how it's affecting other people and how it creates courage in other people. It's been incredible. A path I never thought I was going to take.
Well, I love that example that you gave where you come into a home and just your very presence is disturbing. And I understand that. I really do. I know that sometimes, when I enter a room, there's a certain amount of disturbance created because I look people straight in their eyes. A lot of times I think they feel a little intruded upon.
Right.
Because I show up, I'm wide awake, and I'm looking them right in the eyes, and it's like, oh, my God, back off. And try to show up a little dead, will you, please? And make everybody more comfortable. So, and Cal, you want to hear something funny? Is that it ends up this whole thing about being fully embodied and playful and happy and full of joy. It rubs off on my animals. So, like right now, I have one dog. And I noticed that she bugs people for the same reason. it's like, why is your dog so, alive and awake? She has opinions. She keeps trying to express herself. It's like, I'm sorry. You were hoping she'd be kind of half zombie or something. But
we have teaching us that.
Exactly. That's why I like being around animals, because usually they are more embodied, and I have worked long and hard to try to become embodied,
And they're usually not apologetic about it.
No. No, as a matter of fact, they seem a little bit proud of it. I know when my dog pees, she's really excited about herself. It's like, look what I did. Yeah, it's very interesting, all the happiness and joy that we're shamed away from it. We absolutely are. So I want to make sure we cover a couple of things before we're out of time here. We've got about 10 minutes left. And I want to make sure our listeners hear a little bit more about Voices of Dignity, and also I know you're doing some fundraising right now. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So with the organization, we're focused on a few different areas. So we have our mother's training. We have a whole team of interns that are working on developing curriculum that we're going to be able eventually to put into schools here in New York, which is also something really groundbreaking. But over the last few weeks, we've been running this campaign trying to fundraise $100,000 for these programs that we're now expanding really fast. And if you go to firstgiving.org/voicesofdignity or my name, you can put firstgiving.org/Cal Holzler and you can do your donation there. And we have a little clip talking a little bit about our programs. And definitely you can, people can always check out our website and see what we do and make a contribution there as well. It's voicesofdignity.org. But the organization is, I'm incredibly inspired and surprised how fast it's growing. It started with me and Melanie Curtin, who's the co-founder, a dear friend and been incredibly dedicated to this cause. And we've gotten a lot of therapists and professionals on board. And so it's a very new experience for me being involved with a nonprofit startup, which I've never done. A lot of learning, a lot of fun experiences that we're learning. But the impact that we see happen with the organization is definitely the thing that keeps me going to continue doing this kind of work. And I've personally and organizationally, we've had some opposition when we started running the organization with smear campaigns and people that were trying to get us to be quiet. And we've continued. So I definitely have seen my experience motivating me to do this. And I've definitely seen how having the experience growing up has taught me to be persistent about what I want to accomplish. And, you know, if one child will have a better life because of the efforts that I'm making, then I'm satisfied. And I definitely know there's lots of people benefiting from it. And we have teams of mothers that are just on fire. Like, we've had this training 2 weeks ago, and out of one training, two mothers would come forth and being like, okay, we want to host two new trainings. And that means another 15 to 20 mothers being in this conversation. So it's definitely, if people want to get involved, definitely and contact us.
Tell us a little bit about the training now.
About the mothers training?
Yes. What does that entail?
We basically, it's 2 hours. We have a professional come to the house, and it's a very non-professional environment. So mothers feel very comfortable. It's more, take an example in Bar Park, New York, in this Jewish neighborhood. A good friend of mine, Mindy, she's been hosting it, and she's been really enthusiastic. We both have a mutual friend who suffered incredible amount of abuse from her father, and she got really dedicated to want to make a difference in the community around sexual abuse.
Okay.
So when I approached her with this opportunity to host these trainings, she invited 15 of her friends, and they've been gathering around food and around conversation. A professional will come, and every time they meet over a period of 8 different segments, they have the opportunity to talk about their personal experience and have the opportunity to get some professional feedback and trainings around how to speak to their children about abuse, and how to be able to watch when their children are acting different and they're suspecting that there's abuse, so at least they have other mothers that they can get support from, and they have a therapist that they can call. And I don't know, I get really excited, so I have to like almost like minimize my words back to the topic we were talking about. But it's every training we watch, we hear these horrific stories, and in the same time, we watch children go into therapy in the cycle of abuse being interrupted. And
right.
I have to say, like, we're definitely not at a complete solution to the problem. There's so many different aspects to it. With what do you do with offenders? How do you confront them? And that's something that the Jewish world is still, I don't think that there are infrastructures and ways of dealing with it. And it's very simple. Like, it's very simple for you and I. Like, when I sit with people at over, like, having a cocktail, or I'm sitting with friends talking about this issue, I look at them and I pick up a glass, and I look at them and I'm like, okay, if I drop this glass right now with wine in it, there will be a few actions to be taken. if I want to have some more wine, I'll get another glass. If I don't want to step on the wine and on glass, I will clean it up. Like, there's things to do. And unfortunately, when I was growing up, as a 9-year-old being raped in a community that I grew up in, there was literally nothing to do. There was no actions to be taken. I couldn't speak to anyone about it. No one would believe me. There was no school counselor that I can trust to speak with. I would never tell my parents about it. So I just had to learn to live with so much pain. And the damage that it creates, the ones that suffer abuse know the kind of damage it creates. The paranoia and the fear and the lack of trust of adults and on and on and on. And that's something that I want to make sure that my nieces and nephews and the next generation of children don't have to go through that.
Right.
So
well, it's a wonderful thing to be able to take, like you said, to take that suffering and help other people. I think it's a wonderful thing. And be able to model for people that there is joyful sex after sexual abuse. I think that's so important. It's such an important message to bring to the world so that, yes, we can take sexual abuse very seriously, but we don't have to take the rest of our sex life so seriously that we never, you know, are able to enjoy ourselves again or laugh, you know, and be
it's
playful.
It's definitely an odd idea. Just the idea that sex is bad is a novelty to me at this point in my life.
Mm.
And especially for people that have suffered abuse, where the association of sexuality is power and dominance and losing control, and whereas all that in its right context can be incredible.
Yes.
Taken out of its context could be incredibly abusive and re-traumatizing. But I must say, like, I won't go into the graphic details, but there was an experience that I had when I was living in San Francisco. I was at an event, and won't go into details, but I was at a point where a good friend of mine, who I must say almost reminded me of my father, and he was standing next to me, and he asked permission, and it was the right context, and he slapped me. And I asked him, and I almost moved back, and I asked him, well, if you're going to slap me, I want you to slap me without holding back anything. Like, I want you to look me in the eye and smack me. And I remember where, like, his body started shaking, and he started sweating. Like, we both went into this place of incredible amount of vulnerability and intimacy, and it's almost I requested for him to hurt me, but I requested it, and I wanted to experience that. And I remember where he moved back and then moved closer to me, picked up his right arm, smacked me across the face, and then smacked me with his left arm. And we both were in this place of, like, there were tears coming down my face, and we're both shaking, and it was an incredible, liberating experience. But at that moment when he slapped me, I was thrown back to being beaten by my father.
Mm.
And the times when I knew my father the most intimate was when I was laying in my own blood and he was disciplining me and beating
God.
Me. But at that moment of having an adult that almost resembled my father and be able to request that experience and recontextualize the experience as pleasurable, like, I can't say there's so much to be said about that, and the crying and the joy around, oh my God, I just felt that experience of being abused, but I was able to re-experience it in a context of pleasure.
Mm. You know.
Taken that experience in all different contexts, in relationships, in sexuality, in doing the thing that is the most terrifying, but doing it consciously and recontextualizing it with choice.
That's the whole thing right there, is that, you know, you're as an adult, you're making a choice to right. revisit this situation and to come out of it the winner in whatever way that sorts out for you. But you know what?
Right.
We're just about out of time here, and I got to say, I think we just stumbled across another whole topic for a show, which really would be to maybe explore some of the elements of BDSM,
right.
And how one can explore healing sexual abuse through BDSM. And I would love to take that topic on at a future date if you want to go there.
Yeah. I would love to have some experience with that.
Okay. All right, Cal. Tell our listeners one more time how they can donate to Voices of Dignity.
You can go check out the website. It's voicesofdignity.org. We can make a contribution and check out what we do. Or go to firstgiving.org/voicesofdignity, which is a website where we're currently doing our campaign. And we would love to write us if you have any questions at info@voiceofdignity.org.
Okay.
And,
And then check for the website on Facebook if you happen to be my friend on Facebook. Cal, thank you so much for joining us in the Shame Free Zone. That's it for tonight, guys. Next week, believe it or not, we're going to be having Aaron Schneider on the show to talk about the benefits of periodic carb loading. So we're going to be going off into diet for a little bit, and I think the timing's great for those of us who maybe overindulged a little bit for the holidays. Talk a little bit about carbs and how it affects your health. Okay, that's it for the Shame Free Zone. We'll see you next week.
Thank you so much.
Good night.
Have a good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mutus kabar berita?